say, I think you're a very well-trained audience. At exactly 1:01, which is polite, it's always right not to be too punctual. You all spontaneously stopped speaking. So congratulations for that. Congratulations for that. Thank you for coming back. And this is going to be, I think, the core of the occasion, because this is where we reflect His Holiness's ideas about youth and action in the shape of four of our scholars, whose work has been certainly, if not created, facilitated by the Trust. So there's a lovely synergy between the Trust's work and the intellectual output that we're going to hear. So we have until, I think we thought 3:30, John, is that right?
Yeah.
3:30. So we have time to build on the remarks that were coming thick and fast towards the end of the last session, because we're going to hear from each scholar, and I'll introduce them sequentially with one or two words about them. And they're each going to speak, I think it was 15 minutes, is that right, guys? There is, as you will observe, a gender dimension here, which, for those of you mystified by it, goes some way to explain why I was asked to be chair. I am the token man in the world of combating intolerance. So we'll have our four, and then I'll sit over here, and they're going to sit, each of them, I think, but we'll see. And then I'll lead the discussion as we did. So I'll be looking for interventions from yourselves in the form of comments, some very good ones just before lunch, which are not hinged on questions or equally questions. And then we'll end with some words from Victoria. So that's the agenda. Fatima, you ready for me to introduce you?
Yes, I don't know if my slide...
The slide needs to be checked. Stan Cohen has written a brilliant essay about the rough guide to conference going, where he talks about slides and the number of slides. How many? Did you use the singular slide? Well, that is well advised. The slide is now up. And Fatima's PhD dissertation, which has been completed in 2009, so she represents one of the earlier of the scholars, comparative to some, and was on the effectiveness of the international prohibition of torture in the context of counterterrorism. I'm delighted to say that she's now a barrister at Garden Court Chambers, one of Maitre's Chambers' rivals. I have no idea why I mentioned it. Fatima, congratulations again on the scholarship and getting your PhD, and over to you.
Thank you. Well, my thesis really developed in the context of the debate after September 11th, which you're all obviously aware of, about torture and its potential use in counterterrorism efforts. And that debate was really about whether torture is justified or not, and if it is justified, when it can be used, a kind of ticking bomb scenario situation. And a lot of my thesis engaged with that question, the question of justification. But I was also interested in questions that grew up around that. And you may be wondering, what does my thesis have to do with tolerance and intolerance? And it was in the kind of related questions that really themes about intolerance and dehumanization in particular grew up. And there are two bits of the thesis or elements of it I wanted to talk about, which I think tie in with everybody else's thesis, although we're all in very different areas. And the first is the question of what's actually wrong with torture, because the debate about justification to me seemed to always overlook that. It was trying to justify a wrong or question whether it should be justified, but the exact dimensions of that wrong weren't really discussed. And it seemed to me that we needed to know exactly what we were trying to justify before we talked about how to justify it. And the second question was about states, because the United States had been attracting a great deal of criticism, as it still does, for its alleged use of torture and its violation of the international prohibition on torture. But it was obvious that it wasn't the first state to claim to obey the prohibition, to stick to the letter of the law, whilst behaving in ways which don't quite fit with that. And it's certainly not the last state to have done that. So I was interested in asking how states had historically engaged with the abolition of torture and the prohibition of torture. And what did the way in which they engaged with the prohibition tell us about the actual prohibition itself, particularly in the form of the UN Convention Against Torture, which really embodies an absolute prohibition in international law of torture and, to some extent, though not quite in the same way, in human and degrading treatment. And it was really in looking at those two questions that I learned a little bit about the dangers of dehumanization, the dangers of systematic intolerance, and the ways in which what seemed to be perhaps relatively minor ways of dehumanizing people can grow and develop into something much bigger. And what I really was interested in is the idea of human dignity and respect, and the idea of autonomous agency, not just the ability to do what you like, to self-govern as an individual, but also the respect for self-government. So autonomous agency as a political and legal status. So just to turn to the first question, what's morally wrong with torture? A lot of the answers to that question seem to focus on pain. Obviously, torture is painful, and that's something that nobody wants, as the Dalai Lama said, nobody wants problems. Nobody wants to be hurt. And a lot of the answers to that said, well, it's the pain and suffering in torture which is what's wrong. And the UN Convention very much reflects that, because it defines torture as severe pain or suffering. So torture is defined inherently as severity. And that's contrasted with inhuman and degrading treatment, which is bad treatment, but is less severe than torture. And I was curious, because if you imagine, for example, someone gets into a fight outside a pub, they're hit with a broken bottle, they might get charged with grievous bodily harm or something of that kind. That type of act, and you could do that to somebody if you were torturing them, doesn't carry the same sense of moral repugnance as torture does. There's something special about torture. And I was interested in finding what that was. And my answer to that is not particularly, it's quite obvious. It's that the objective of torture is not something that's obscure. It's to break a victim, to destroy him, to really get him to the point where he has no option to but reflexively comply with the demands of the torturer. It's to bring someone to that point. And so pain to me seemed to be not what's wrong with torture, but just a method of achieving torture very effectively. And so what I argued is that that moral wrongness is the annihilation of agency. It's not just aligning the victim's will to the torturer's will. It's not just coercing him. It's really shattering his will completely. And I found when I was doing my research the quote from an American citizen who wasn't tortured in the traditional sense. He waterboarded himself to see what it was like. And he wrote this account of it. And this really sums up, I think, that moral wrongness. And this is someone who wasn't in a hostile construct. He consented to this. He said, "All hell breaks loose. Instinct tells us we are dying. I have never been more panicked in my whole life. Involuntary and total panic. There is absolutely nothing you can do about it. It would be like telling you not to blink while I stuck a hot needle in your eye. At the time my lungs emptied and I began to draw water, I would have sold my children to escape. There was no choice, no chance, willpower was not involved." And it's really that concept of not, agency just being harmed or just being dented, but actually completely shattered, that I thought the moral wrongness really lay in torture. And to me that made sense for a number of reasons. One of those is because actually not all torture is painful, physically painful in particular. For example, some states are said to be developing techniques of using MRI scans to look at brain activity. Some states have attempted to use painless drugs. A colleague of mine who is working on extradition cases has worked with an individual who's going to be sent back to Eastern Europe, a particular Eastern European state, where as a sex offender he might be chemically castrated. That would profoundly affect his body and his gender. And that is going to be physically painless. Of course, it contains some amount of psychological trauma, but what's so disturbing about that, I think, is the idea that someone is misused in that way, that they act against their will. And of course, torture is subjectively experienced. What's torture to me might not be torture to you. For a devout Muslim, having the desecration of the Quran, having his beard shaded off, being forced to watch pornography, might be profoundly agonizing. It might not be that bad for someone else who experiences that. There was that famous sort of story that went around about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who apparently endured minutes, you know, up to 2 minutes of waterboarding, where lesser US soldiers only lasted for 14 seconds, or something of that kind. So it's clearly a very subjective experience. And that's where I felt, or I found, that dehumanization really came in, because those that design torture and perform it seemed to me, really do so with a mind to individual, cultural, racial, religious, gendered sensibilities. They design torture along those lines to best exploit the way a person feels, thinks, and believes. And in fact, there were two studies done in Israel of interrogation of Palestinian detainees. There was a 1988 study which suggested, just from the small group of people they surveyed, that 95% of those detainees had experienced some kind of nationality-based racial or religious abuse or threats when they were being interrogated. And a subsequent 2007 report by a different organization suggested 73% of detainees had experienced that. So it very much was a case that that to me suggested that that's where the real wrongness of torture is. It's in that kind of misuse of the person and annihilation of their agency. And when I thought that that was what was wrong about torture, it meant that the traditional distinction between inhuman and degrading treatment on the one hand and torture on the other hand wasn't so relevant anymore, because it's not just about pain, about inhuman and degrading treatment being less, because both very much affect dignity and agency. And it seemed to me that where you have inhuman and degrading treatment, particularly in terms of the conditions in which people are detained, the type of abuse they suffer at the point of apprehension or arrest, what you can create, especially where there's dehumanization, is an atmosphere of permissibility. And that's a byproduct of the lack of protections for certain classes of people, particularly where in a place like Israel, you might have one set of protections that apply to normal, regular detainees in criminal prisons, criminal cases, and another that would relate to terrorist suspects. And actually the same in the UK, one set of criminal procedure for those people and another for regular people. And as someone in the Bush administration wrote, those types of dehumanizing conditions set favorable conditions for interrogation. They make it easier for torture to happen. And so part of what my thesis found is that it's vital for international law and international human rights law to treat inhuman and degrading treatment exactly the way that torture is treated. There shouldn't be different obligations and slightly different levels of prohibition for one and not the other. And just to go on to the second question about states, because the theme of dehumanization came into this quite a lot as well. When I looked and I went back to the Middle Ages in Europe and in England, when the abolition of torture in Europe really happened, to see how states had dealt with that. And when I looked at that, I found that historically and still, states had always said, yes, we've abolished torture, yes, we absolutely prohibit torture. But they had narrowed that prohibition in certain ways in practice. And some of those were based on not extending the same protections to certain classes of people. So particularly, who could be tortured? In terms of England and her colonies, Britain and the colonies, the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya, those people were not subject to the same traditional abolition of torture as people at home would be. The French in torture of Algerians, that was a similar kind of theme. And then, you know, what and when and how torture was prohibited. For a time in Israel, before 1999, when the High Court issued a decision, there was what was called the defense of necessity, and this was a potential defense in law for the security forces, that when they were dealing with a ticking bomb type scenario, they were allowed to revert to a defense of necessity in terms of interrogation techniques, that we had no choice but to use those techniques. And what it really meant is that Palestinians would be subject to those techniques, and it was not, in the years that it was in existence, not one member of the security forces was ever brought up on charges of misusing this. They always had access to that defence. In fact, whether or not they had that defence was decided by someone in the security forces. So it's very easy, once you other people, as that word was used, once you set them outside the legal framework, outside protections, particularly when they're of different races, it's very easy for that type of situation to develop. Recently, there's a big battle between the Supreme Court and the Bush administration about whether the US Constitution and its protections, which the US claims the US Constitution is enough to embody the prohibition of torture in American law. There's a big battle between the Supreme Court and the Bush administration about the right of habeas corpus. Who does the Constitution apply to? Does it apply to people outside of the United States? And that was an ongoing debate. And also how and what, so what is torture? Again, there was the famous Bush administration memo that suggested because the convention defines torture as severe pain or suffering, you could then define severe only to mean injury that reached fatal or near fatal levels. Anything less than that wasn't torture. And why it was used, it's quite morbidly amusing. But back in the 17th century, English jurists were very proud of the lack of torture as a tradition in the common law. They often compared themselves with France and those barbaric people and how they would torture and we wouldn't torture and we're so sophisticated. But in fact, you could do what we would think of as torture to people, not for the purposes of interrogation, that was not allowed. But for example, in criminal cases where a defendant refused to enter a plea, you could crush them with weights until they decided to enter one. And that was a perfectly legitimate criminal procedure. There's a case from 1615 where a murderer refuses to enter a plea, and the judge makes this order. He should be extended and then to have weights laid upon him, which were little by little to be increased, that he was to be exposed in an open place, in the open air being naked, that he was to be preserved with the coarsest bread that could be got, and water out of the next sink or puddle to the place of execution. And that day that he had water, he should have no bread. And that day that he had bread, he should have no water. And in this torment, he was to linger as long as nature could linger out. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the defendant, hearing that order in court, entered a plea immediately. So it's obviously very effective. But it's quite clear that those themes of dehumanization crop up again and again in torture. And I think what the theme of my thesis ultimately was is that torture as an act and as a political tool and as sometimes a legal tool is really the most profound manifestation of a lack of respect of dignity and of intolerance. It's the purest, the most clearest way to disregard another human being. And any state that adopts it, formally or otherwise, really runs a danger of undermining whatever system of rights and protections they have. And that's the reason I chose this picture on my slide, because this is a picture of a detainee in Iraq and his son. And I feel very disturbed every time I see that picture. But what's happening in that picture, most courts and many scholars would tell you, is not torture. The European Court of Human Rights, in the case of Ireland and the United Kingdom, said, well, hooding on its own is inhuman and degrading treatment. It doesn't arise to the level of torture. But clearly what's happening in that picture is many of us would think torturous. It's a profound violation of dignity of that individual and his child. And it's a clear example of dehumanization. And I think that's where it's very difficult for courts to say, this isn't torture because it's not painful enough. This other thing is torture because it is. My thesis found that the convention should be restructured. It should take into account a more subjective concept of autonomy rather than focusing on pain. Because otherwise you have states who do something like that and say, it's absolutely fine, we are obeying international law and we respect human rights. And that picture does not respect human rights in any way whatsoever.
should say that Fatima's thesis was completed at UCL, and I know we're at LSE, but one of the nice things about the Bonnet operation has been how it's worked with UCL and LSE together, and I think we should acknowledge that teamwork, which makes this a kind of London initiative. Now, I was also thinking, and I want to push this idea out for discussion later, what is the connection between academic work and outcome, you know? And what's the connection between legal work and outcome? Here we have Fatima, who's an academic dissertation, pitching for the idea of autonomy at the end, and also involved in cases. And I can see immediately the connection between law and outcomes, and there are some fantastic cases. People are not being tortured abroad because they're not able to leave the country because law stops them because of cases. And we heard a powerful argument for what underpins the prohibition on torture: dignity, autonomy on your developed idea. But we need to acknowledge, and this is what I throw out, that academe can do tremendous harm, as can law, alluded to in Fatima's speech, and I feel very strong about this. They can get lawyers to redefine torture, and we had that in the 17th century, we had it with Mr. Bush, the president, being told by some opportunistic, relatively useless lawyers who spotted opportunities for advancement, that by presenting the president with a short, easy-to-read paper, which said you can do what you want, they get ahead. And there was something not dissimilar happening in our own jurisdiction on other matters at the time. So part of what we need to do as academics and lawyers is fight bad faith versions. And that's also the case with regard to intellectuals. What President Bush was able to do with the collusion of various people in various countries, not only our own, was work out an intellectual framework for basically abuse. And he didn't do it all by himself. He did it with intellectuals who worked out that some evils were necessary because they were being done by us to protect us from other people. And this got quite a head of steam going with various people who are very distinguished, some of them calling themselves professors of human rights. So we need to think about the value of academe as an exposure of self-interested, self-advancing heresy. And therefore, in a way, academe at least has that important job. So have a think about it. We'll see. Victoria, I think you might be the very first Bonnard scholar. Is that true?
No.
First here. The Francesca's the very first.
Yeah.
First at LSE. Victoria's dissertation investigated that, this is sociology, so I have to read it out extremely carefully. The temporal, spatial, and social nuances of citizenship and political being among the Urdu-speaking minority in Bangladesh. Have I got it right, Victoria?
Yes, thank you.
Away you go, you're 15 minutes, and your slide is already in place with the happy news that you've successfully completed your PhD.
Thank you. Well, following on actually, directly from where you left off, Fatima, in this paper, I'll be examining a case in which it could be argued the denial of social, economic, and political rights is as brutal a form of torture as anything a state can inflict. My research examines the transition from statelessness to citizenship among a linguistic minority in Bangladesh, focusing on three key aspects of intolerance and challenging some of the ways in which intolerance has been depicted. So the case that forms the basis for my research has its roots in the historical aftermath of colonialism, and in particular the partition of the Indian subcontinent in 1947, which generated some of the greatest displacements in modern history. Altogether, around 18 million people left their homes in the first two decades after the creation of Pakistan, 700,000 of whom were Urdu-speaking Muslims who migrated from northeast Indian states to East Pakistan. Many fled violence in states such as Bihar, hence the name Bihari has been used in reference to the community ever since. It actually came from much further afield: Orissa, West Bengal, UP, etc. And throughout the 1950s, under a Pakistani regime and sharing certain cultural and linguistic similarities with the Pakistani elite, they occupied a position of privilege in East Pakistani society. But following the liberation of the country in 1947 and the war in which millions of Bengalis were killed by the Pakistani administration, their position shifted dramatically. And in the aftermath of war and the subsequent creation of Bangladesh in 1972, those known as Biharis were branded enemy collaborators and socially ostracized. Thousands were arrested and executed, and others, having been dispossessed by the state, were forced to flee. So many ended up in temporary camps constructed around the country on an ad hoc basis, some with the help of the International Committee for the Red Cross, but many without. And these are some photos from the camps today. These pictures are actually taken in the largest camp, which is in Dhaka, which is Geneva camp, where much of my fieldwork was carried out, but it was carried out in camps all over the country. And 160,000 Urdu speakers live in these camps today, displaced for 40 years. For almost 40 years, they were disenfranchised, completely isolated, and considered a stateless population by the international community. But in 2008, the entire Urdu-speaking community of Bangladesh were finally granted citizenship in what was considered a landmark High Court ruling. My research was conducted between 2007 and 2009 in Bangladesh, so it captured that formal transition from statelessness to citizenship. And for those in the camps, it's not just been political rights that they've been unable to access, but a range of further social and economic rights, such as employment, education, access to healthcare, etc. But as I discovered when I arrived, that a small minority of Urdu speakers who hadn't been displaced at the time of liberation and had been able to retain their houses outside or rent properties outside had actually been accepted into the nation in all substantive respects ever since, even in relation to some of the more symbolically salient political rights, such as voter registration and passports. As Parvez here explains, I accepted citizenship just after liberation because I was living outside. There were others like me outside the camps. We all got citizenship. In the camps, they had nothing. And obviously, the distance between those Urdu speakers outside the camps and those in the camps has grown dramatically in the intervening 40 years. As Suman here adds, the camp is always part of your identity. When you're living in the camp, you have a different identity that will help you get into school or get a commission certificate for a job. So what's been traditionally understood as a case of ethno-linguistic intolerance is actually much more complicated than that. And clearly much has changed since 1971. Today, in the space of the camp, poverty redoubles ethno-linguistic discrimination. And stigma works through discourses of dirt, pollution, and purity to influence the way that ethnicity, culture, and language are read and understood. And today, a camp identity actually appears to be the source of intolerance over and above a specifically ethno-linguistic one. In that sense, my research suggests that intolerance needs to be understood as the multi-layered and dynamic social process that it is. Here in these camps in Bangladesh, intolerance has a profoundly spatial register that's complicated by the interplay between space, poverty, ethnicity, and the way all of this has evolved over time. As a number of my interviewees explained, because of the relationship between space and identity in this context, movement in and out of particular physical spaces has actually now become a condition of legal recognition. These are some photos. It's a photo of a family I interviewed who'd moved from the camps and were now living outside. And as Tuni here explains, we moved from the camp 4 years ago. we get many advantages living outside, like voter ID and an address that I can give freely to people. We're treated better by others, and we're citizens. We get self-respect living outside. So once that physical boundary is crossed and status transgressed, a range of relationships and opportunities become available. Notions of citizenship, therefore, that rely on rigid constructions of formal legal status and binary oppositions between statelessness and citizenship are clearly challenged by such processes. And this leads me on to my second point, which is that, as I discovered, actually, those in the camps have also been accessing citizenship informally for many years. Sometimes through movement outside the camps, as the previous quote described, but sometimes by using a fake address to access government schools, passports, and even ID cards. And Shamim here explains, yes, I will vote in the upcoming election. I voted in the previous election with a fake address. It's very easy to hide your address and cast your vote. I've also had a passport for 11 years. I used the address of my relatives outside the camp, so it was real. But if they said no, I'd had to bribe them 6,000 taka. In this context, clearly, movement outside the camps, or the decision to acquire a fake ID card, or even the bribing of passport officials, could all be seen as acts of citizenship, in the sense that they're about claiming rights, enacting yourself as a citizen. And the point here, really, is that intolerance debates generally assume a passive victim. But in showing a stateless population access rights, my research challenges those assumptions. The indeterminacy of the camp and the intolerance that camp residents face does not necessarily produce the camp as the dehumanized passive space that scholars such as Giorgio Agamben or Michel Aguirre have depicted. So in May 2008, after nearly 40 years of statelessness, the camp residents' rights were constitutionally recognized in a high court ruling. Citizenship, it was argued at the time, was the route to rights and recognition and therefore equality. As a result, UNHCR declared this case a considerable success story in the fight for equality across the globe. However, interviewing camp residents themselves, many were less convinced. And interestingly, many of those who had obtained an ID card using a fake address actually continued to use those rather than obtaining a real one since the ruling. As one interview here explains, before the High Court ruling, I had an ID card made anyway with a fake address. I kept this one. It seemed better. And Shabnab adds, the official ID card indicates that I'm a camp dweller, so it doesn't help getting jobs. As others explained, in some areas such as employment, a real ID card with their displaying their actual camp address was unsurprisingly more of a burden than a benefit. What this shows us is that if intolerance is only dealt with through its outcomes, through the granting of citizenship to those who've been denied it, for example, and the sources of intolerance are not themselves addressed, then those outcomes may remain very empty. As long as they're identified with the camps, discourses of dirt, poverty, and pollution cling to them. And citizenship, it appears, will not be effective as long as the stigma they face as camp residents remains. So it raises the question, what is the value of normative, liberal notions of rights in contexts in which real substantive access to goods and services and social value is much more fluid, messy, and opaque than such notions of rights accept. In summary, camp-dwelling Urdu speakers may be neither citizens nor non-citizens in any tangible sense, gaining access and being denied access in different contingent and contextual moments. My research shows just how deep the historical roots of intolerance very often are, but it also shows us that its form shifts in time, and it suggests that Western liberal notions of rights must be complicated by an understanding of the way intolerance is manifest and experienced today. But importantly, it suggests that the victims of intolerance are not as passive as they're often presented. The camps I encountered in Bangladesh drew lines of division and difference, both materially and symbolically, but there were nonetheless lines that could be crossed. And the younger generation, the 21st century generation of camp residents in Bangladesh, are today crossing those lines, dealing with intolerance at its source through education initiatives and cultural forums that bring camp dwellers together with non-camp dwellers and Urdu speakers together with Bengalis, creating networks and establishing communication. As my research shows, an understanding of intolerance requires a better understanding of the way it's experienced at the level of everyday life and the informal strategies through which it's contested and negotiated by those who feel its effects. It requires better understanding of the active social agents that continually challenge its limits, all of which speaks to the 21st century generation and the youth and the action that the Dalai Lama spoke of this morning.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much, Victoria. And I've obviously been thinking about my earlier questions, and clearly what sociology does is provide facts which force some people against their will to have to restructure their approach to life, everyday life. And so that's certainly a reason for academic work, stopping us just accepting whatever the latest fashion is in the media. And that's what came through very strong from that great presentation. Abby Kinnan is from UCL, archaeology. PhD getting close to completion.
Yes, yeah.
Very good. But started like 3 years ago, not 13 years ago, so don't get that's it's exactly on course. And the dissertation is about the role of archaeological inventories in cultural heritage management. And it's in a particularly interesting context. The context, I think, it's of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. Over to you, and welcome.
Can I take it from there?
You may, indeed. You may, indeed. Just let's make sure that the microphone fits with you, but that should be fine.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, I'm from archaeology. I'm taking you to a completely different direction and a rather more subtle form of intolerance. So, as Conor said, my research is framed by the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. And my fields of research are the practice of archaeology and the management, interpretation, presentation of cultural heritage sites in the West Bank. One aspect of heritage management is documentation, the creation of databases, of inventories. The goal of my research was to explore the nature of archaeological documentation, both from Israeli and Palestinian sites in the West Bank. Investigating into inventories, into databases, is in fact investigating into what is considered important, culturally significant. But at the same time, it's also looking into what is not being promoted, what is being silenced. Therefore, I tackle the issue of intolerance from the cultural perspective. Okay. So working within the recent rise of human rights and ethics movements within the discipline of archaeology, one of the most prominent theoretical approaches in my research is the post-colonial approach to the study of power relations. Knowledge production, when it is related to cultural power and political dominance, they have an effect on the archaeological practice and vice versa. Political power can then be translated into what could be termed archival power, meaning institutional power over resources and knowledge production. Now, to give you an example, which is not from my region, but just to give an example of what I mean by archival power or the power of recording, I'm going to quote the historian James O'Toole, speaking about the conquest of Mexico by Cortes. A conquering army proceeds inland in the face of the enemy, encamping with his men before the first fortified town to offer resistance. The commando makes the appropriate military plans, sending a detachment of troops around to attack from the rear while he leads an assault from the front. But before the battle begins, however, he conducts a strange ritual. An interpreter stands in front of the troops and shouts out a proclamation to the opposing camp. The proclamation tells them that if blood were spilt, the sin would lie on their heads and that resistance would be useless. The expected response was shouts of defiance and a shower of arrows from behind the fortifications. But then an even stranger thing occurs. The leader of the invasion causes the proclamation to be written down, duly recorded, and a notary who is traveling with the army precisely for this purpose attests to the fact that the warning has been both given and recorded in the proper form. Only then the battle can begin. The town is quickly overrun, its inhabitants slaughtered. So this is an example how powerful documentation can be and why it is important to research this aspect. Now back to archaeology in Israel-Palestine. Biblical motivation were one of the major Western interests in this region, and this took form as expeditions seeking to corroborate biblical narratives, while at the same time the history and culture of the local communities were of much less interest. The result of this Western archaeological activity in Israel-Palestine, which started in the 19th century, was the creation of a corpus of data that represented the way they looked at archaeology and heritage, what they thought was important. Now, taking this into the issue of current Israeli research interest and heritage management priorities, as an academic discipline, the Israeli archaeology, it started off as nationalistic, so it took, it inherited in a way the colonial practices of European and American archaeologists. But it is not nationalistic anymore, so it has moved beyond nationalism. It's much more professional, it's critical. However, in Israel, there are a lot of different types of public consumers that can take archaeological scientific results and interpret them to suit their own religious or ideological points of view. This could be settler groups, religious groups, or any other sects in the Israeli society. For this reason and others, biblical and Jewish narratives have been more researched in general, lacking balance with other narratives, other historical narratives. Palestinian institutions, on the other hand, they promote different types of cultural heritage. They don't specifically focus on archaeology. A lot of the types of heritage that they promote is more relevant to the Palestinian community. This could be historical architecture, local crafts and traditions, oral history, and archaeological sites with some emphasis on Islamic archaeology, ethno-archaeology, and refugee camp archaeology. So promoting this type of Palestinian heritage strengthens a sense of pride and unity among Palestinians in the face of the Israeli dominance over the creation of cultural and historical narratives. This promotion of heritage can be seen as a form of an anti-colonial resistance. Now, I suggest in my research that cultural and historical values and ideological values could be traced down within archaeological documentation and different aspects of data management. So I will give a few examples of how it is manifested in West Bank inventories, focusing a little bit more on Israeli inventories, since as an Israeli archaeologist, I'm a bit more familiar with them. So, for example, the West Bank and East Jerusalem archaeological database covers all the archaeological activity that's been done by Israelis since the occupation in 67. Now, many of these surveys, archaeological surveys, that were digitized for the creation of this database aimed at a full coverage, meaning an equal and objective collection of data from all periods. However, many of them were motivated by the identification of biblical sites or Jewish-related sites from the Bronze and Iron Ages. So, for example, in many cases, some periods were not documented as well as others in surveys that aimed at an objective coverage. So, for example, in the archaeological survey of Benjamin, it is noted in the methodological notes of the survey that it is possible that in some areas the collection of Ottoman ware was somewhat insufficient, or obviously the relative portion of pottery sherds from the Ottoman period in Arab villages does not represent the real quantity of pottery sherds at the site. So some periods were just not covered as well as others. Usually it would be prehistoric period or the later periods when the Ottoman period, which is the most relevant to the Palestinian residents, was much less researched and documented. Another example is Operation Scroll. This is a project of surveys and excavations aiming at locating scrolls left in caves of the northern Judean desert where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. This project was conducted immediately after the signing of the Oslo Accords between Israel and the Palestinian National Authority in September 1993. And the goal was to quickly recover any remaining Roman period scrolls still hidden in caves before this area was transferred to the Palestinian Authority. So in this case, the database or the map generated from this database reflects Israeli national interest. As you can see on this map, the yellow line marks all these, the very intense dominance of caves that were researched. So that's one of the things that the database can reflect. Another example is excavations. So if you query a database, you can look at trends over time of research interests over time. So, for example, if we look at sites that were excavated by Israeli academic institutions, a few trends could be observed. For example, all the sites that could be assigned with a cultural or religious value were excavated because they were either biblical, Jewish, or Christian. Obviously, there are Islamic sites that were excavated, but they're not reflected on this map because they were not researched. Another trend is there's a focus on biblical sites, academic focus, along the central hills of Samaria, it's right here, or the Bees. And another example is a specific focus of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, focusing on Judeo-Christian sites east and south of Jerusalem. So these are the red squares of the Hebrew University. So looking at Palestinian inventories, their heritage inventories are much more diverse. They don't necessarily focus on archaeology. There is an archaeological database created by the Palestinians, which is still underway. They're still creating it, the Department of Antiquities and Cultural Heritage. Other inventories focus on other aspects of Palestinian heritage. For example, maybe the main Palestinian inventory is the one created by RIWAC, which is the main Palestinian NGO dealing with traditional architecture. And the aim of this database was to record everything, all the traditional Palestinian buildings, in order to safeguard the Palestinian building traditions and way of living. Other local inventories also focus on Palestinian heritage. Another architectural inventory is made by the Center for Cultural Heritage Preservation, who focus on, it's also a Palestinian NGO, and they focus on the Bethlehem district. They are creating an inventory for traditional Palestinian buildings in this region. Other aspects of Palestinian heritage are also being collected into archives. They reconstruct Palestinian identity by the focusing on the past collective archival identity and history. An example is the Nakba archive, which is a collection of film testimonials of Palestinian refugees. Other examples are online archives of newspapers, photographs, posters. This type of inventories reinforce the Palestinian cultural identity through focusing on a collective past. There is a need among them to counter the Israeli interpretation, the dominance of Israeli interpretation of the cultural and archaeological record by creating their own corpus of knowledge on the past. So there is an imbalance of archaeological and cultural narratives that is still very dominant in Israel-Palestine. And this imbalance sustains a cultural intolerance of a stronger society towards the history, the past, the culture of the weaker society. So to take a pragmatic view on this, I would suggest that professional archaeologists and heritage manager practitioners would promote accountability and reflexivity, challenge institutional agendas by exposing links between institutional interest and reconstructions of the past, strive to achieve a shift in power relations, reassess and revise research methodologies in order to avoid bias and selectiveness as much as possible, and recognize the power of databases, question them, criticize them, as they are never objective. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that really interesting set of remarks. Databases are never objective, and I've now discovered another way in which academics can make a difference. They can go look at data which nobody really wants people to look at, where, to use your words, the established narrative has decided what truth is, but it doesn't want facts to get in the way of the established narrative. And academics can be quite tough, where they say, I want to know the facts. Facts are very subversive. They aren't alternative facts, they're simply facts. In the field of human rights, for example, there are some countries that believe that they are tremendous advocates of human rights, but you'll never catch them agreeing to have any court from an international body overseeing their conduct. They're very happy to be, for example, able to host various cultural and sporting events because they are, after all, committed to human rights. But when you suggest that they perhaps could permit themselves to be overseen by an international human rights court, they get rather anxious, and they do because facts might get in the way of self-description. So we've heard, I think, a very dramatic, and if I may say so, rather brave example of academic work at a cutting edge. The fourth, and we're not doing badly, mainly a little behind because of me, is Amanda. Amanda Conroy, LSE, Gender Institute, more or less just started. So we need to give Amanda a big hand because her work is beginning, and it's an extraordinarily, well, they're all interesting, but an extraordinarily interesting topic, which is about ideas of masculinity, citizenship, and state sovereignty in the Minuteman movement. Now, Amanda will tell you a bit about it, but these are loosely organized groups of US citizens who organize patrols of the US-Mexico border in order to protect what they call national sovereignty and prevent illegal migration. So we're already, I hope, riveted. And your 15 minutes start more or less now. Thank you.
Well, I hope to keep you riveted. Can you hear me all right? It's okay. Good. Well, first of all, thank you very much, Fatima, Victoria, and Adi, for giving me three very hard acts to follow. I'll do my best, though. Kind of like Victoria's, my research considers ways of political being, although in a decidedly altogether different sort and context. So I study a far-right anti-immigrant movement in the United States. And what my project does broadly is to explore what it means, how movement members understand what it means to be a political being as a member of a national community, how they understand how and under what conditions political decision-making should be made, and how, as political beings, they understand, as members of a national community, to whom they have obligations, moral obligations. In particular, what my project does is to explore the ways that the moral philosophy that they employ to make sense of these things is influenced by a much older, more mainstream, and perhaps for that very reason, more insidious moral philosophy, which has its roots in a Western Enlightenment tradition which values rationality over emotion, which values self-sufficiency over entanglement with others, and which was formed in a particular time and place by a white subject against its over-embodied, less civilized, racialized, and feminized others. So that's a tall order. I hope I can do it in 4 years. We've only got 2 years left. But I'm not going to go into all of that today. yes, lucky you. Mostly, I'm going to try to discuss two things today. Mostly, I'm going to discuss the kind of emotional and mental work that we might need to go through in order to explore the moral philosophy of people like this. And I'm also going to, like Victoria, to complicate how we envision intolerance manifesting in those that we mark as intolerant. So I study a certain facet of the anti-immigrant movement in the U.S., namely the border control movement, more colloquially known as the Minutemen movement. And what these movement members do is they patrol the U.S.-Mexico border. They also do bordering activities that are usually reserved for the state, such as disrupting irregular job sites that migrant workers use to gain employment, monitoring employers of suspected irregular immigrants, and actually reporting irregular immigrants to the authorities. And Minuteman leader Jim Gilchrist explains the logic behind this movement in this way. If simple enforcement of U.S. law becomes too heavy a burden or a nuisance for elected and appointed members of government, then it's up to citizens to fulfill the destiny envisioned by our founding fathers and accept the challenge of exercising the right to self-governance. In my research thus far, it's a very complicated moral philosophy going on here. what I have found is that I don't get a lot of overt expressions of, you know, say racism. It's not, we don't want you here because you're Mexican, because the color of your skin is brown. It's because certain behaviors or qualities are aligned with certain bodies. Regular immigrants, many members think they are criminals, they're gang members. They work cheaply, and so they bring wages down for all Americans. They're a drain on the state. They take too much in terms of taxes. They don't give back enough. And the reasons for being involved in this movement are not always wholly or overtly self-interested in nature. You know, they narrate their involvement in terms of what's best for the nation, what I want for the nation, for my community. And while in the bottom is the bottom quote, you can see often they reference personal loss and hardship. It's frequently referenced in order to make sense of national domestic issues that they care deeply about. Like many other right-wing groups, gender and race-driven identity plays a significant role. Most of the members are white and male. And like other right-wing movements, they use masculinity, as Michael Kimmel writes, as an ideological resource to understand and explicate their plight, as a rhetorical device to problematize the identities of those against whom they believe themselves to be fighting, and as a recruitment device to entice other men to join them. As one gentleman told me when I asked him why he decided to get involved, he said, as if it was the most matter-of-fact thing in the world, well, a man needs to be king of his own castle. Okay. I became interested in this movement for several reasons, really. For one, the militarization of the border in the wake of NAFTA and the weakening of economic controls in the region has created a massive human rights issue. There are thousands and thousands of desert deaths as border crossers are increasingly forced away from safe crossings and populated urban areas and towards more and more dangerous routes across the desert. In a 2009 report issued by the ACLU and the Mexican National Commission on Human Rights, they estimate that 5,600 unauthorized border crossers have died as a result of these measures. Second, they are, you know, moving increasingly mainstream, and actually much of the Tea Party leadership takes its leadership from the Minuteman movement. The Minuteman movement really stole the spotlight in the U.S. from 2006 to 2009 or so. But beginning in 2008 to 2009, the Tea Party has really been, you know, the go-to far-right group in the U.S. But a lot of that leadership actually comes from the Minutemen movement, and it's changed the rhetoric of the Tea Party a lot, from its roots in a libertarian approach to economics to increasingly taking on a more nationalist and nativist tone. But mostly, I became interested in this project because I think it has ramifications for how we think about citizenship, how we think about our duties to one another as cohabitants of an Earth rapidly changing as a result of globalization and economic integration, and how we think about the tools that we have at our disposal, such as the territorial boundary and the sovereign nation state, these tools that we have to make sense of our relationships to one another. And it's for these reasons that I think it's necessary to care about the far right, and not only because their actions can result in significant human rights abuses and can serve to radicalize the mainstream, but also because they represent a moment in which these grander, older political logics reveal themselves. Nothing takes place within a vacuum. As Rhys Williams writes, sociopolitical movements cannot create their versions of the public good out of whole cloth. There's an historically and culturally bounded repertoire of constructions from which movements draw elements in various combinations. Movements find their niche in the political terrain by tapping into recognizable rhetorics and symbols. So in the course of this talk, I would like to talk about some of the ways that my research participants have made sense of their relationships to others, how they understand their relationship to their country and to their community, and the emotional and moral meanings that they invest in their decisions. In doing so, I'm hoping to make the beginnings of an argument for studying the right wing, the far right wing, in a more generous and, dare I say, tolerant fashion. In the course of my study so far, and I'm about halfway through, I've done a fieldwork in March and I'm going back in July. But in the course of the study so far, I have to admit I've heard and read many things which have understandably greatly disturbed me, to put it mildly. You know, hateful speech towards Mexicans, towards irregular immigrants. In fact, one of the men I interviewed did time in jail. He shot a man in the face in the parking lot of a fast food restaurant because he called him a stupid American. I spent a month doing interviews like this in March in the southwestern US, and it wasn't a rare occurrence for me at all to, upon leaving the interview, to pull over a few blocks later and cry. But the times I have to admit that I found the most disturbing was when I left interviews kind of confused myself, when I couldn't neatly put people into boxes, you're evil, you're racist. When I was confronted with the sheer visceral humanity of my research participants, and when I was moved by the kind of morality that they put into play, even though I simultaneously found it problematic. And when I started to do my fieldwork, I was really struck by something. And this is going to sound like a very strange statement, given what I've told you about this movement so far. But when I began speaking to them, I was really struck by how moral they were. I'm going to explain more about what I mean by that in a minute. But that was I wasn't expecting to find that. The dominant assumption when we think about these groups is that they're acting in their own self-interest out of some kind of innate, irrational hatred. They're selfish, they just don't want to share, they're racist, they're evil, and then we can leave it at that. But I find that there's something about labels like racist, that serve to take the humanity out of the person to whom you're applying it. And this really worries me. And there's this tendency to render these behaviors outside of the realm of the human. And when we do this, it makes it easier on a day-to-day basis to deal with ourselves, perhaps, as humans, and to deal with others as humans. But I think it's a really dangerous tendency, and I'm going to explain why. Paper is, you know, by no means meant to be an apologetic. I don't condone the actions of these men or their moral logics that they use. But I do, however, see a great danger in banishing them from the realm of humanity. Which is what happens when we label them racist and fail to engage more deeply with the logics, the morality, and the humanity of those involved. In 1989, Zygmunt Bauman wrote a very important book, I think, entitled Modernity and the Holocaust. And in Modernity and the Holocaust, he really warned social scientists and others against the urge to cleave the Holocaust off and to deposit in some kind of pre-modern, barbaric, other place. The Holocaust is shuffled into various categories. This is cultural oppression, religious oppression, racist oppression, sheer genocide, just evil, hatred. And what he says, what this does, it precludes deep engagement with might be the most important and painful part of it, which might be its implication with us, with what we do and what we value. I look back over human history, and you can see two things. I think you can see the concept of the inhuman being used as a logic for violence towards the destruction of other human beings, certainly as we saw in Fatima's talk. But we can also see the concept of the inhuman, after the blood has been spilled and we have recovered ourselves, used to cleave these acts away from the realm of the human again. Genocide, hatred, racial violence, these are done by inhumans. They're not like us. They're different. And when we do that, you know, this doesn't mean that morality is absent. I'm haunted by this passage that Claudia Kuntz, a very famous scholar of the Holocaust, this passage she relates in the Nazi conscience. She's talking about the memories of a former Hitler Youth member, Alfons Heck, on seeing his Jewish friend Heinz taken away by the Gestapo in 1940. Seeing his friend taken away, he says to himself, not how terrible it is that they are taking the Jews away, but how terrible it is that Heinz is Jewish. So it's not that Heinz did not show up on Heck's emotional register. It's that he's unable to translate that emotion into a critique of the system. He's unable to bridge that rationality. He's unable to do so because his duties towards Heinz as another human being are hindered by the moral universe in operation at that time, the moral universe that rationally he is told that he should be a part of and support. This moral universe tells him that it is proper and right to love Germany more than he loves Heinz, that any moral obligation he might feel towards Heinz is far outstripped by the far greater moral obligation he has to the nation. And this, I think, is very important. When we talk about whether or not something is moral, or someone is moral, frequently what we're talking about is whether or not they are right, which is not exactly the same thing as saying whether or not they are moral. By moral, returning to what I promised I would elaborate on earlier, by moral, what I mean is, are they animated in their actions and decision-making by a vision of what the right thing to do is? And when we don't think of it this way, when we don't inquire into these things, we halt inquiry into exactly what kinds of morality are in operation. In the course of my research thus far, I've found several kinds of moral engagement at work. And the first is represented by the quote behind me. As for what my opinion is of illegal immigration, well, I have absolutely no sympathy for the so-called plight of these people. The American people are currently in the middle of their own plight. American children are homeless. American families are hungry and homeless. American veterans are homeless. And here we have a regular immigrant beyond the horizon of his moral engagement. They don't exist in the same moral universe. They don't require the same duty of care. But it has done so in order to preserve a different moral universe. This man that I was speaking to, he's a very active member in his local community. He takes his sons to visit disabled veterans on the weekends. He does volunteer work with local police. He's a former gang member. He, you know, routinely goes and speaks to high schoolers about the dangers of being in a gang. He's a mentor, a big brother. And throughout our conversation, he was really deeply concerned about the fate of those who, in his eyes, belong to his network of obligations. And the presence of irregular immigrants disrupted this network of obligations that members of the national community had to one another, and the result, homeless children, veterans, families, etc. And this kind of reaction was quite typical, actually. Participants were very critical of other members of the national community, such as on the left, that put their emotional investments in the plight of irregular immigrants above what they thought to be good for the nation as a whole. They prided themselves on their rationality and being able to determine who their moral obligations were to, and their ability to sieve out any emotional claims that might disrupt that network of obligations. I just want to warn some of you, on the next slide contains quite a disturbing image. So I did think it's important to include it, but if you are queasy, you might feel better looking away. This image was posted on a website after a border watch, done by, not an official border watch, one done by the Minutemen. And it's accompanied by the first quote underneath. And here we have a different kind of moral engagement. We have an acknowledgement of a moral obligation, of a certain entanglement with others. But the moral thing to do in this case is to ultimately to sever this entanglement. Enforcement of our immigration laws would be a start in protecting our country and protecting people like this, who have to die to try to find a better life. We must put pressure on our government and keep the pressure on our people to stop exploiting these people and send them back to Mexico. In turn, the abuse going both ways will be resolved. We are freeing slaves. We are the good guys. I found that some of the harshest criticism was reserved not for immigrants, but actually towards big businesses that exploited cheap labor, towards politicians that turned a blind eye. Many actually acknowledged the pushes and pulls that cause irregular immigration. And in fact, many said that had the tables been reversed, they would cross the border legally as well. So there was an element of kind of a compassionate relationality, an acknowledgement of an ability to read into the motives of others. But the answer to the economic disparities between the U.S. and Mexico was to secure the border, to seal it. Many said that we would actually be doing Mexicans a favor by securing the border, because then they would be inspired to create change in their own country, instead of relying on us to do it for them. So we're seeing an acknowledgement of a certain network of obligations, but the obligation is not to offer charity, but rather to create conditions in which the other can help himself, to create conditions of self-sufficiency. And to do that requires dismantling that very network of moral obligation. And lastly, I'd like to talk very briefly about some of the personal and emotional investments my research participants had in being involved in this movement. When they talked on their involvement, they talked very frequently about their duties to the next generation, to the country that the next generation would inherit. One participant explained his involvement in this way. I feel, as an American, I must take a stand. I feel I must get my point across, and I feel like this first venture I'm starting is going to make a name for who I am and what I stand for. At the end of my interview with Gary, his pseudonym, who had spent 20 years actually down the border before most of the movement had really become a right-wing zeitgeist, he spent 20 years down there. He had lost jobs, spent money, lost his wife, and he reflected on his decision to get involved. I mean, you get older, he said, you got to do something. You got to have meaning. You either got to start drinking, or you've got to do something. This is something that is meaningful to me. Their involvement frequently involved massive amounts of sacrifice on their part of time, money, and relationships. They were incredibly critical of other Americans who, in their words, spend all of their time shopping and watching reality television. They really took pride in something, and they truly believed that they were doing something meaningful, important, right, and good. And it was these times that I was the most disturbed, when I was moved. And I'm going to leave you now with some words of Alexander Solzhenitsyn on the necessity of recognizing human frailty in this way. If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. To take the step and say that morality is involved means to open morality up to inquiry. And to do so is to open it up to revision, reinterpretation, and dissevelment. All of a sudden, everything is on the table. We're not sure if we're right, and this is really scary. But I do believe that we must confront the full gamut of our humanity if we are to achieve peace. And to do that entails recognition both of our capacity to do incredible violence towards other humans and our capacity to do incredible divine acts of love towards other humans. But we have to do both at the same time, because when we don't, we inhibit our ability to look at ourselves closely. We inhibit our ability to track our, for lack of a better word, inhumanity back to our humanity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amanda. Just not just reporting, but explaining, and most difficult of all, empathizing. Quite tricky. So academia is about more than just reportage. We have some time. We've had four first-class presentations. They provoke a lot of questions in me. For example, the connection between what we just heard and maybe the Ku Klux Klan of the past, whether there's anger towards the black man has now turned south, I don't know. But they must have provoked a lot of questions and thoughts from you as well, or you may have more general reflections. So it's all yours in the usual way. We have our microphones, one of which might work and the other of which might even work too.
I think they should hopefully both work.
They should both work. And usual rules, if you catch my eye, a gentleman already has, a lady has, that'll get us started. And we'll take a cluster, we may or may not come to you guys, depending on how it goes. Okay, so quite a lot is happening around me. And you can go to this gentleman here, who'll get us started. Sir, your name and question or comment.
Ali Al-Agra, Emeritus Professor of International Economic Integration. I would like to make a general point. I really find all the cases extremely interesting, and it will take a long time to ask questions about them. But I would like to relate to this to the first session as well.
Please.
The title is Tolerance in a Just and Fair Society. We talked about tolerance, and we told it's not something static, something changing over time. But what is the fair and just society? I can't see the connection between the two. Is it the tolerant society, the just and fair society, or the fair society has to be tolerant? But if tolerance is something not so clear to identify, where are we?
Well, I think that's left hanging in the air, Professor. But we expect people like you to deliver the answer. That's why the state has paid you for as long as it has. Do you have any suggestion as to what you might say by way of an answer to your own question?
I think that requires a lot of research.
More government money.
Because what is a fair and just society for me is a society that's tolerant, but tolerant in the more general sense, accepting individual perceptions of different
Absolutely.
Things. But what I'm suggesting is that that is not something so simple.
Yeah.
You really need to connect the two sides of the research.
Absolutely. I remembered listening this morning to the IRA slogan, which is peace with justice, not just peace. And justice is a tough word, and I thought His Holiness dealt with justice in quite a challenging way this morning. You may now have the microphone. Excellent.
I'm Linnea. I'm a student at the Gender Institute here at LSE. And my question is mainly directed to Amanda, but I guess a bit to Fatima as well. And I was listening to what you were saying about the dichotomy between rationality and emotion, and I was thinking, in terms of their strong moral convictions and anyone's strong moral convictions, how do you actually find tolerance in a society where a lot of people have these strong rational thoughts that then lead into moral convictions? And in terms of emotions and their removal, their traditional removal from the public sphere, like how does that play in?
Thank you very much. And we have this lady here and we have that lady on the side there. So, madam.
Thank you. So it's Ivana again. So
also one of the Bonnet Scholars, I remember, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Good, okay.
Okay, so I have two questions. Fatima, sorry, I was a bit late on yours, so I didn't hear whether you were at all investigating the private forms of torture, let's call it that way, so violence against women or other forms of torture and the responsibility of the state, and what the differences or connections were with the publicly inflicted torture. And secondly, for Amanda, I have to say that I have a bit of a problem with kind of a moral relativism that I seem to kind of get. I have no problems with compassion towards the people themselves as human beings, and I think this shed the light on how people do what they do, where they come from, what the problems are, but I don't know, I think we still need to have a language to condemn the deeds themselves. Otherwise, we cannot even speak of universal human rights principles, and the problem is that if your network is only a network of the beings that you associate similar to you through nation or whatever, then is that really universal morality, and how does that relate with human rights and human rights violations?
I mean, I'm reminded of our first intervention about the idea of justice suggests some knowledge of something. And we had that earlier with Lord Perec as well. Is there a floor to multiculturalism? These are themes emerging here. Madam, saying who you are.
Yes. Yes, I'm Dundas. I'm a student here at the LSE for Human Rights. I'm pursuing a master's in that. And mine is just a comment based on what I've heard all day. It's something struck me, which is, I suppose, something that Britain being in the multicultural society that it is, and one of its facets being the claim to tolerance is coming towards, is that particular intersection of conflict where you have claims to to moral relativism and multiculturalism, as well as the idea and the need for equality and human rights, and you have a sort of conflict emerging within those. And I think that it's really important to recognize that conflict, because for us, as people who want to protect human rights, and as I suppose having a liberal ideology where we say that all human beings should have access to certain rights, and it should be something that are options for them, available to them realistically, because a lot of the times, in respecting cultures, and I am from a Muslim background, so, and I'm also speaking from that sometimes protect multiculturalism and moral relativism can mean a lot of injustice and rights violations for vulnerable groups, especially women. But then at the same time, the opposite can also mean violations of that nature. So it's a very tenuous place we're at, aren't we?
Yeah, and difficult. And that's one or two or perhaps even three interventions. I'm going to take this gentleman, and then I think I will have you, sir, and then we might go back to the panel. But there's some themes emerging here which I'd be really interested in having from you. Sir, saying who you are in a short question.
Jonathan Marcus, I spoke earlier from Freddie Bonnard. Just like I thought they were four cutting-edge presentations, and I think anybody who I will probably offend at least one of you by saying describing them as sort of social sciences, but anybody who doubts the value of research in the social sciences should listen to those four presentations, and I think they would realize the useful work you do. I know a lot more about America than I do perhaps some of the other subjects. I just wanted to make a comment on Amanda's paper. I thought it was particularly brave, not least because of her own engagement, if I may say so. And I think it was actually very important, because I do detect, speaking as a public broadcaster, with absolutely no political views of my own, a very slight left-wing tinge in the audience, if I may say so.
I don't know if we'll give you permission to say that. Can you bring your remarks to a very speedy close, please?
But it does strike me, you know, I was reminded some 20 years ago, Bernard Tapie, French socialist politician, said that the people who voted the French National Front were bastards, and their leaders were bastards too, or in fact he said it the other way around. And I think what you're doing is very important, because I think the people who support these groups cannot just be dismissed as being beyond the pale. I think that an attempt to understand their motivations, where they come from, what they think, and indeed, as I think you bravely highlighted, potentially the positive elements in this rather mixed up melange of ideas that they have, I think is very, very important.
Yeah.
So I think it's
thank you.
Good luck to you.
Yeah, I think that's an important addendum. Sir, we need to have help with the microphone.
Bahauddin Latif. Actually, I was just...
And you are, sir, sorry, and you're from?
Bahauddin Latif, for ATS. I wasn't going to ask any question, but I thought about Victoria's contribution. Which sort of puzzled me. She said something about troubling for Western liberal values. By the way, I thought her presentation was slightly skewed. I'm a bit surprised that she got a PhD for doing that, because I can't imagine someone discussing Israel-Palestine, for example, in the same way, because the issue of Urdu speakers in Bangladesh is more complex, because many of them decided not to seek citizenship. They wanted to go to Pakistan, West Pakistan, to join the Urdu-speaking people in Sindh. And the other thing was the India-Pakistani ISI was very much involved using funding from Saudi Arabia, etc., to try and keep this issue festering for Islamic reasons and other reasons. So I thought it was a bit biased, because these people did not gain citizenship or integration into the society, because actually they did not want, they refused to have Bangladesh identity at all. So I thought it was a bit strange, because I think people here will get a completely wrong idea. And the idea that somehow this is connected with troubling Western liberal values. I thought it was a very, very strange thing to say. And may I say one thing? This Amanda is doing an incredibly brave project, because I think this is the sort of thing we need to know. We cannot, how can I be unaware of this other facet of our society, which in many ways actually is bedeviling Europe too, mainland Europe in particular. And one last point, because you're from Ireland, I think your accent. I was just wondering, you know, in the context of tolerance and just and fair society, because in my view, Northern Ireland is an issue which probably needs highlighting, because we live in Britain. And within the British context, this puzzling anomaly in Northern Ireland, where actually tolerance and also just and fairness and what it means to the communities has tremendous relevance, in my view, in the context of the discussion we've been holding today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I think what we'll do, we'll run a few minutes over. We want to hear from Fatima, Victoria, Adi, and Amanda. And we also, right at the end, just before I conclude this session, want to hear very briefly from Victoria. There's been quite a lot of interesting ideas emerge, and we're going to be disciplined, guys. I think perhaps we'll run it as we did at the start. So, Fatima, could you take what you feel you want to mention from this, and we'll run down the line, and then we'll end with Victoria, and I'll send you off to you.
Just to deal with Ivana's question, which was about forms of torture, private forms of torture versus ones performed by the state. Because I was looking at it mostly in the context of counterterrorism, I very much looked at state-focused torture. But that being said, it's often the case that it's not quite clear where the line is drawn between private torture and public torture. Firstly, in the way states talk about torture. The United States at one point tried to argue that they didn't have to implement the prohibition of torture into their legal structures because every individual state already prohibited torturing another person. So it's clear that that's a criminal code, but how far that would apply to state bodies is questionable. But secondly, states don't just have the obligation not to torture people, they have a positive obligation to prohibit torture, which means that they should make efforts to eradicate torture. And one area which seemed particularly alarming to me, particularly in Western states, which have formalized structures of human rights, are issues like violence against women, where many people in a society are regularly suffering severe pain and suffering. And it's not clear whether the state's obligations to prevent torture extends to preventing that kind of violence. And that's an area which people haven't looked at very much. But there is very much a sense that the lines sometimes cross between what's private and what's public, also because sometimes the bodies that do the torturing on behalf of the state are not the state. They are private militias or private groups or paid groups like Blackwater and organizations like that. Mm-hmm. So that is an area which is very controversial, I think.
Thank you very much. Victoria, you might want to deal with the gentleman's comment, regrettably briefly.
Yes, I'll comment briefly. I think it's a fair point in the sense that obviously there's a huge complicated history here that I haven't had a chance to discuss. And in 1972, that the gentleman is correct, the camp population were surveyed and asked whether they wanted the citizenship of Bangladesh or Pakistan. Obviously, this is in a context in which they've just been displaced, lost their homes, and they're fearful for their lives, but 60% chose Pakistan. Pakistan never took them, it took a small proportion of those that applied to go to Pakistan. So, in the end, those that were left in the camps were left with nothing, neither Pakistan nor Bangladesh. But obviously, it's a hugely complicated political history. It's still incredibly politicized and political today. And in that sense, I want to move beyond that, those politics, and talk more about the experiences of intolerance and citizenship today.
Thank you. I think what we might do is, we might just have a conversation over tea. We might have a conversation over tea because really we have to hear from Adi. Adi?
Well, I wasn't asking any question. I understand that archaeology is quite alien in this problem. So I'm just going to make a general comment picking up on something that Amanda has mentioned, and that is a network of obligation. Mm-hmm. And something I think is applicable to all the talks here. I think that it all goes back to social psychology. So how we as social beings maintain a collective identity, and it's very natural that we would have a preference to benefit our own social network, whether it may be family, city, nation, or whatever. But I think it's interesting to see that people would have different circles of or network of a social group, and the way they apply themselves to this group, people would just view these things differently. So I think that's important to emphasize and to understand.
Thank you. And Amanda.
Thank you. I'm going to quickly deal with two of the questions I was asked, and inadequately, so we can have a longer discussion over tea. Linnea, thank you for asking about the relationship between rationality and emotion. My best quick answer is just look at what happens when we do remove emotion from the public sphere in terms of political decision making, and when we rely on rationality. What happens to human rights? Human rights are connected to the nation state. Mexico provides your human rights. The U.S. provides your human rights. But these don't really connect to the realities of how people inhabit the earth and how they move across the earth. They take crazy risks to walk across the desert in search of a better life. It doesn't really rationally connect that way. And rationally, there are 1,001 reasons why we might have no moral obligation to them. You chose this. You wanted this. You're not my countrymen. You're not, et cetera. I don't know you. But there are groups of individuals that say, sod it. I'm going to put, I'm going to work for Humane Borders. I'm going to put water tanks in the desert because it's the right thing to do, because I emotionally feel connected to you as another fellow human being. And that's important. I apologize that I don't know your name, but hopefully you'll come and introduce yourself later. Thank you for that. You pulled up a really good point that perhaps I did not make clear enough in future presentations. I'll try to make clear. I am not in any way arguing for moral relativism, nor am I arguing that what they're doing is right, or even moral in the sense of the word. What I was trying to do is disconnect the notion of what is right to what is moral, or to locations and times in which moral engagement is happening. I was trying to say that there is moral engagement happening here, not necessarily that it is right. And in fact, I'm trying to make a bit of a stronger case for a more diffuse, deeper moral engagement with others. I think it's very important for reasons that came up in the last section with Roger Griffin, who I'm certainly going to have to buy his book. It's a lot of what he was talking about, recognizing the nomos, the meaning that people have in a certain, in my case, moral universe or cultural sphere. And because it's really important to do this, because if you don't, if you're just looking for the fascist, the evil person, the totalitarianism, if you get, time travel back to Nazi Germany and that's what you're looking for in order to, stop what the Holocaust or what's going to happen, what are you going to find? You're going to find people that love their families. You're going to find people that have a Jewish friend. You're going to have people with a sense of humor. You're not going to find what you're looking for. And so we need to think of things this way so that we can see what we're supposed to be looking for now so that we can prevent these kind of things from happening in the future.
Thank you very much. Now, just before I dismiss you for tea, Victoria has a few words to say on behalf of the scholars, and then it's back to me. Victoria.
I'll be very, very, very quick. I just wanted to say on behalf of us up here, but also on behalf of all those scholars who are in the audience today, I'm sure, to thank particularly, obviously, Freddie, but also the Trust more generally. And just a personal thanks, I think, from us four, particularly today to Francesca and John for all the amazing hard work they've put into organising today, and above all, to the enthusiasm that they've shown throughout. It's been fantastic, so thank you.
That was agreed by all of them and represents, I'm sure, the view of all the Bonnet scholars here. Now, we have tea. I'm delighted to report that I think I see Trevor Phillips upstairs. Is that right, Trevor? There he is, proving he's here. And we're back for a 4:15
yes.
Kickoff. Before you go, why don't we collectively show our appreciation of what was a prodigious effort by fairly young scholars, Fatima, Victoria, Addy, and Amanda. Well done, well done.